Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 330th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton. I'm here with my co-host, Sean Wisniewski, Diami Plotke, and Mark Hicks. And today we're visiting with Curtis Buchanan, master chairmaker, designer, teacher, mentor, and a whole lot more, I think. I guess avid gardener, too. Yeah. But so welcome to the show, Curtis.
No, thank you. Thank you, Kyle. Glad to be here.
And welcome, Diami. It's been a while.
It has. It's been too long.
Yes. Great.
Glad you guys got the ship going.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Well, let's go ahead and get started with some woodworking news. And found a few things out there, probably near and dear to the chairmakers among the listenership, as Elia Bizzari has started a green wood source list. So it's like a common spreadsheet that people can go in and fill out sources of green woods, green wood in their area. So if you know anybody that, you know, is selling logs or selling green wood or something like that, you can go out to that source list and fill it in. And I think it's going to be a real handy resource. So, and you can find out more about that on Elia's website, which is handtoolwoodworking.com, because he's great and got that domain before anybody else grabbed it.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah. And anyway, and he has a blog post on there. And the blog post is titled Green Wood Source List by you for you. So, check that out.
Yeah. It looks pretty kind of open. Mm-hmm. Almost like anybody could add anything. It's kind of a smattering of only a few states at this point in the United States and just one area in Canada. Nothing, Australia is named, but nothing's there. I mean, it's looks like it's just starting out, but that's kind of a really cool idea just to have this. Hey, here's a shared document. Who has it? Because some people are going to have it all the time, and some people are just going to come upon it. You know, where I got some stuff from a buddy of mine, it was somebody called and said, hey, I'm taking a maple down. Do you want it? You know, and then all of a sudden, a few weeks later, that was kiln dried, you know, cut, you know, four square lumber.
Right.
And, you know, that's great. That's really cool.
Yeah. Unfortunately, around my neck of the woods, there's not much green wood unless you want some southern yellow pine. Mm-hmm. Got plenty of that.
I'd take that. Yeah, that'd be great.
But anyway, but moving on, some sad news in the woodworking community. Phil Lowe passed away. Mm-hmm. And I think, as anyone on social media has probably seen a number of tributes to him, I think one of the best summations I've seen is on finewoodworking.com site. They have a blog post called Remembering Phil Lowe, and it has a bunch of comments from a bunch of woodworkers and former students of his. So it's a real sad time here in the woodworking community, but all the best out to his friends and families and students and whatnot.
Absolutely. And I think it was on your favorite social media platform there, Kyle, but Freddie Roman had a really nice words to say about him.
Yeah,
I think I saw that actually.
Yeah, and I think they have Freddie Roman's comments in here. Yeah. I don't know if it's exactly what he had on Instagram, but he has a little thing. There's probably, I don't know, 10 to 15 folks that have little tributes to him. So that's sad news, but And more sad news is Norton Rockler, the founder of Rockler, also passed away. I think this might be more of a celebration of life. I think he was 98 years old when he passed away.
Yeah.
So good run and a big influence to most of the woodworkers around here. I don't know.
Yeah.
Almost everyone's been into at least a Rockler store at least a few times. It's sad, but he's done a lot for woodworking. So it's a life lived well. So. Anyway, and finewoodworking.com also has a blog post about him, too. So you can check that out. It goes on a little bit about the history of how Rockler started and everything. I didn't realize it was called, another company is called Minnesota Woodworkers Supply Company.
Rolls out of the tongue.
Yeah, right. That's what it started out. Yeah,
I always find it funny. Even the company I work for is a guy's name, and it's a funky word, and it's not a name I ever knew, you know, around town growing up. Same thing with Rockler. It's like it sounds like something, but you never know that it's Mr. Rockler started that darn thing. We know that yeah. makes sense, and good on him. I mean, it's been a resource to countless, I'm sure.
Oh yeah,
it was the only. I mean, it took forever for me to get one near me. Or anything like it, but it you know, I heard about it before I ever saw one, but it was like, yeah, that's a great, great shop, and you know, good.
I've never seen one in person.
Have you not?
No, we don't have.
I guess the one I did see was inside a place called Woodworks near Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
We were in town for one of the wood shows, and they had an event, so I drove over there with my kids and walked into it, and like half of the store was a Rockler store. Everything was blue, you know, by default, it was all blue. But no, yeah, that's a sad of the passing, like you said. I think he made a good long run at it, and
yeah, I guess
helped a lot of people along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we're lucky. Yeah, we have a Rockler store in Houston, and then I think we have two Woodcrafts too. So
lucky.
Yeah, well, they're all 50 miles away from me, but here in Texas, that's just right down the street. So.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, also have another thing, and this is strictly for Mark. And Grizzly has come out with a new machine that might be beneficial for you.
We don't have Rocklers, but we do have one of the two Grizzlies in Springfield. And they just came out with this twin head dual blade bandsaw. And I was looking at the specs on it. It seems like it'd be perfect for somebody who's doing like timber framing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah.
You can cut beams and you can cut the top and the bottom of the beam at the same time. And I think you could feed smaller logs through it. It based on the opening size, it looks like you can only do by 10 by 11.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be able to shove a big log through there. You'd have to have another mill, but you could take the load off of your mill. You know, cut slabs off and then turn them on edge and run them through this thing to cut a lot of beams.
Yep. Yep.
Make your own custom 2x4s. It says it right there.
That's right.
Bespoke 2x4s.
Bespoke dimensional lumber.
But yeah, it's only $16,995. So, you know, it's cheap at twice the price. But I figured I'd throw that in for Mark since he's the only one I really
they
know.
Have a
that moves heavy slabs like that.
Yeah, I sadly I don't think it would be big enough for workbench making. They do sell like a normal sawmill for about $6,000, but it's only one blade, so you know you'll have to make two cuts, one cut at a time.
That's no good.
Oh,
you need just two of them, one behind the other.
Yeah, right. One left side, then right.
Yeah, I'm sure Matt Cremona will come up with anything. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, well, let's move on to what's in the shop. So, Diami, what's in the shop?
The latest thing I've been doing is some PVC trim.
Okay.
It's kind of like woodworking.
Yeah,
shed work.
Let me take listeners back. Back in Vandalist's days on Wood Talk, got to be less than episode 50, early episodes. Somebody wrote in and asked if they could cut PVC with their normal woodworking blades. And those two yahoos were so cautious and not willing to put a good blade to the gentlest plastic in the world. To this day, every time I cut PVC, I think about that. But it mills just wonderfully. I use my biscuit cutter in it, use plastic biscuits with it. I use my pocket holes, but they're not particularly fine woodworking. But no, it's just blowing up PVC trim. I'm building a shed. I'm still framing out that, trimming out that shed that I started before Sean's.
Oh, okay.
I made quick work of a project in my shed. I really did. You make that comment totally aside, but you know, as much as that you think of that for PVC, I think of that anytime anybody puts aluminum to woodworking tools.
Oh, see, I would never do that. You don't.
No, hell no. But I know it works, though, because it's a soft, malleable metal. And the speeds that woodworking tool, yada, yada. I mean, there's all reasons why it does work. And I'm just like a bandsaw or rotating like table saw and people taking aluminum stock through it just baffles
my mind. if those are the tools you have, my mindset is of twofold, is that the woodworking tools are the precious ones. You don't put metal on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have also grown up doing sheet metal work. So I actually have metal tools.
Oh, there you go.
So it's kind of, it's like, I would never even dawn on me to use my woodworking tools on the metal, because that's what the metal tools are for.
Right.
Well, I'll let you know how it works out, because I'm going to cut some aluminum extrusions on my chop saw, but I don't consider my chop saw fine woodworking.
No, from all cases, I mean, a carbide tooth can cut it without issue.
Yeah.
It's not going to mar it. You're not going to get it. The teeth aren't going to get gummed up with
no
sap or anything. You know, I've got some dirty ass blades that have gone through some nasty woods.
Yeah, I'm
sure aluminum would have no issue.
Yeah, and that's what I'm going to do. I got a fairly nice blade on my chop saw, and I'll take it off and put on the one that came with it, and which is also a thinner curve, which would probably work better anyway.
So, now that being said, the times that I've cut like siding, mm-hmm. you know, not PVC but plastic siding, mm-hmm. That's when I use the worst blade known to man.
Is that like the vinyl siding?
Yeah, like vinyl, right? But I turn it backwards so that you don't get the chip out from the teeth falling on it. It more just kind of burns it backwards.
That's how you cut like a corrugated metal, like a real cheap agricultural metal roof panel.
Mm-hmm.
You use a plywood blade backwards.
Yeah. Okay. Huh. Mm-hmm. Screams like hell, though.
Oh, my God. It is the loudest thing. It's like a banshee.
Yeah. It's bad.
Ooh. So.
So that's what's up in my metal shop.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, what are you working on?
I am closing in on the completion of 4 shave horses right now and getting ready to start, to continue working on the kits for the workbench class that's coming up in a few weeks.
Yeah, fantastic. So when's that class starting?
Well, I'm hoping to start in mid-February.
Mid-February.
That's about as detailed as it gets.
Okay.
I set a goal to ship the kits by the end of this month, mm-hmm. and I still might make it. these shave horses are just kind of hanging around. but I'll get them out here in the next week and I'll be able to do 2 or 3 things at once with these workbench kits. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of, multitasking going on here in the next few weeks.
That class mm-hmm. sounds awesome.
It really does.
I think it's going to be good. I it's the first time through. I mean, I've planned what I can plan, and we'll just learn from all the mistakes. I've gone through that with all the first rounders. I said, look, you know, I'm relying on you all to straighten me out. You know, when I screw up, if there's a problem, if there's something that can be made better, please tell me, because it's definitely a work in progress, and everybody was good with that. So it should be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, looks fantastic. It looks like a fantastic course. And I don't know. Maybe Curtis can give you a couple of pointers on doing this remote learning stuff. So
I don't know anything about it. I think what Alia tells me.
There you go. Well, Sean, what are you working on?
Nothing. It's winter time.
You're not making rockets? Come on. They fly in the
gray.
Cold.
Yeah, they do. You know what? Well, I did. I took my nephew out and I flew some small things the other day. But no, I should. That's over in the corner. But I literally haven't even gone into that side of my basement in weeks. It's just mm-hmm. other things going on. Can't help it. Sometimes you just get out of it.
This is shop season, Sean.
I know. You know what, though? And it is totally a symptom of working at home. I work in the same basement that my shop is in. And so when I'm done with 8 hours of dealing with other people's problems, I walk You're upstairs done. And I don't really come back down. It's just a weird thing, but it's this year has been more of that than ever, but it's what I'm dealing with. You know, I know you're right. I will pose this question, because this is kind of something that we've been talking about that is shop related. What would be the easier addition? Blowing out the back of a kitchen and putting in a whatever foundation and just making another room, you know, added onto the kitchen, or building a new garage in front of the garage.
The garage.
Okay. And then building.
You don't even have to go further than that, because you're not.
Building living space into the garage. That's what my wife wants to do.
The garage is all easy framing, and it's just walls. Like the kitchen, you're starting to move off cabinets, and there's a reasonable chance you're going to get into plumbing.
Well, I think no matter what, we're going to expand the kitchen, and there will be that plumbing and stuff. I mean, it's a small house, but it's like a 12 by 12 kitchen. You know, and we're a family of 4 for the next few years, at least, until my kid moves out. And we've lived like this forever, and it's fine. But we're like, no, it'd be nice to have a little more space, you know. And so we've been thinking about that. My garage is 600 square feet. That's almost 2/3 of my house. It's crazy, but and I have plenty of land. I'm on 3/4 of an acre, so putting a garage in front of my garage would not be a big issue at all. I have 100 foot of driveway, so cutting that by 20 feet wouldn't be a problem at all. Just a thing. It'd be a little easier to.
I'd go for the garage.
Yeah, the only thing to me is how to deal with the floor is not in good shape. The block holding it up has a couple cracks in it. I mean, there's like those kind of things. It is a full 10-foot ceiling in there. Do I step down into that space and make it like tight to a slab, or do I build up a framework to match the house floor?
I would build up a framework.
I think I would too, but that's like a huge expansive space. I mean, it's like framing. I mean, I'm gonna have to put a beam in.
Okay.
To carry it.
You know how to frame.
That's true.
It's a weekend's work. It's not hard.
Yeah, that's true. And
it kind of guts me to kind of give up that space. You're leaving a really big plenum underneath there. But that said, there's something nice about it being all contiguous with the rest of the house.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I mean, a step down would work too, making it somewhat. But
it's a step down, I think the terrorists win.
And we must not negotiate. All right. Yeah. So that's been on mind, you know, as a thing to do. Okay. More to come on that. Still have to figure out what that does to the roof line. That's the biggest deal.
Yeah.
When you're trimming that out, you can use my cordless framing.
You know, I have a pneumatic one that works great.
And I have your book, so I really shouldn't be saying anything.
I know. Somewhere we need to have our mail pass in the streets. We'll exchange what we have of each other's. Anyway, Kyle, how about you?
By all means, you're welcome to use that nailer.
Thank you. Kyle, what you got going on?
It's like every time I'm on the show, I got a new batch of jigs started because I keep getting these orders. So, I'm working on a new batch of jigs. But I'm trying to make enough so that I have a small inventory. And I think that's probably the 15th time I've said that on this show, but we'll see how it goes. So I'm working on that, and eventually I'll get back to, the Galbert rocker I've been building forever, which is a shame because the only thing left I got to do is the fun stuff. I mean, I've got all the joinery done and everything for it. I just need to carve the seat and finish carving the arms and just put it together. So hopefully I'll get that done since it's supposed to be for my mom. But anyway, her birthday's coming up. I don't think I'll make that, but maybe I'll make Valentine's. We'll see.
There you go. I was going
to
ask
you. It's another reason to celebrate.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Could just be the completion of that project.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But you put up a video of you making more jigs and that drilling operation. And I know it, whatever, but I looked at it and I said, how are you not supporting? I know that thing's not that long. It might be what, 10 inches long that you're drilling into.
No, it's less than that. It's what is that one? That one's about 7¼ inches.
Okay. Yeah. I'm looking at that spinning in a chuck on one end and the drill bit and that's a fairly large drill bit you're plowing into it.
Yeah.
Have you ever had any instability in that?
No. In fact, that's a safe way to do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know it is because it's basically, I mean, it's like a live end center.
Yeah. Yeah. When I first started, I wasn't using the chuck. I was just actually had the actual drill chuck in the drive. And then I would just hold on to the piece with it backed into the tailstock and rotate the tailstock in there. And it's doable and a bunch of people do it that way, but it's a little sketchy when you're dealing with pieces that short because, you know, that drill bit spinning underneath your hand. So I quickly moved on to the chuck. But I actually, you know, once I mounted in the chuck, I actually put the tailstock and bring that up. So I get everything centered and then make sure everything's running true. And then I take the tailstock back and then I'll put the drill chuck in the tailstock and do it. But, yeah.
I was just thinking of some small sort of a steady rest, you know, but I mean, That's just me being overcautious.
It looks longer than it probably is.
Yeah, that might have been it.
I don't know if I could get a steady rest. Yeah, I could get a steady rest on there. I do have a steady rest, but no, it's not necessary. As long as it's running true and it's good, solid mounted into that chuck. I've never had any issues.
Yeah, and you're drilling through the center of rotation. So it's not, even if it's crooked, it'll still drill.
It'll still do it. Right. Like I said, then that was is the live center, the bit itself.
Now, we'll say this, you got to have hearing protection on because that thing screams like you wouldn't believe.
Do you do that in one pass or do you have a step?
No. Well, actually, that was the middle one because I got a larger Forstner bit. I drill in first. That's for the washer that goes in there. And then I got a 5/8. That 5/8 holds the threaded inserts. And then I have a half inch hole that goes all the way through about 5 inches into the big one. And I have to do that in like three steps because my tailstock won't advance that far. But so I have to advance it like 2 inches, then, move everything and then advance it another 2 inches, move everything and then advance it the final inch. So, it's doable. It's just time consuming. It takes some time to do all that. But anyway, I think
have you tried putting beeswax on your drill bit?
Yeah, I've tried all kinds of stuff. So,
okay. It works in a drill press. I don't know, that you may have a bit in there for too long for it to work.
Yeah, luckily I'm switching bits back and forth, so I don't really have any problems with heating up. It will scream occasionally at you. And go, eh. But yeah, I've tried some lubrication and it works for a little bit. But
yeah,
when you're drilling, when you got a 6.5 inch drill bit buried 5 inches into a piece of wood, there's not much going on there is going to keep it from screaming, but let's get on with see what Curtis, what are you working on in your shop?
Well, every morning I carve a spoon, so that's every day.
Well, good. Typically, are you going to have some of those spoons for sale soon?
Yeah, I put them up for sale once a month.
Okay. I always miss out. I see that they're up, and by the time I go to your website, they're sold out.
Yeah, it surprised me that. That's one thing that COVID's done, and I think it's done with a lot of people, it's given them some, as much opportunities as it's taken away, it has provided some opportunities or forced people to come up with some. And and I've carved spoons for, a really long time, but I've always just given them away. And if somebody wanted to buy one and they came by the shop, they could. But then back maybe... I don't know, May, I thought, I canceled all my classes. So, and that's where the bulk of my income was coming from. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I better come up with something. And I thought, I'll throw up a bunch of spoons for sale. And they sold real quick. And then they've continued to sell real quick. So, and I just love carving them. Especially carving one. I mean, I wouldn't like carving five spoons a day, but I really enjoy carving one and at times two, but that's rare. It's always just one. And but you build up a lot of spoons carving one a day.
Oh, and, I imagine. Oh, I
bet. It's 30 a month. So I end up putting up somewhere between 20 and 30 for sale every month. Last December, I didn't get any up for sale because so many people stopped by the shop and got them.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I'm working on, let's see, I just put the plans for a Potter's chair up for sale this evening. And so Jeff and I have been working on those since probably about last May. Then I had, Jeff wanted two. He trades for his work, as you all are probably familiar with. But so he wanted two Potter's chairs. So we got them drawn up to a certain point, going back and forth a few times. And then once we got what was really close to the final draft, then I made the two for Jeff, going over the plans really close. And then I send all those corrections to Jeff, and then he sends it back to me, and I go over it again. And there were a few corrections, all my mistakes, which they always are. They're never Jeff's. always mine. And found a few. And then finally you get them, and I get the chair photographed, and, you know, get the guy who does my website, because I don't touch that stuff, to put it up. And finally, you know, I get the plans printed, and I get the tubes, and I get them all right. rolled up and signed and in the tubes. And then everything's ready to put up. So that's what it was tonight. And I put them up for sale. So
I was checking my email before the show, and I saw those dropped. And I think Mark added them back to the to talk about a little bit about Patra's chair.
Okay. Yeah,
put that back
to that, or you want to talk about now? Whatever you want to do, Mark.
Yeah, we can talk about it now. So yeah. Well, where did Patra's chair come from?
Well, Patra was a friend of mine from way back, and from college days. And I always like to say we went to different schools together, which is an old joke, you know, but I put that in the email, because I know people ask about it. So I wrote about Patra. And in the early 90s, she was married, lived in a contemporary house, and she wanted some chairs, but she didn't want, I was only making traditional chairs at that time. But I was really wanting to branch out a little bit. And so she wanted me to design her a chair for her house. But I had seen a chair in the back of a fine woodworking. It was actually a 1986 fine woodworking. And it was those little tiny block advertisements that are in the back. And it was for a school in Montana called Primrose School. And they were advertising an instructor that was going to be there. West Lowe was his name. And they had a picture of this chair, just a little thing, you know, couldn't have been more than an inch high. But you could see it. It was clear. And I just, I loved it. And I filed that in the back of my head. Whenever Patra wanted me to make chairs for her, that's the one that popped up. And, you know, of course, if you took a picture of my chair and you made it that size and you put it next to it, it would probably look really close to it. So, you know, there was a lot of inspiration from that chair, but obviously I couldn't see the details, especially how he did the false miter up in the corners up there. And so I had to come up with that and the shape of the seat. And he did his more cabinet maker stuff with dry wood. And I think he upholstered the seat maybe or something. So I wanted to make the seat kind of look like it was of a different material. So I kind of carved it like it was puffed up. And then I daubed paint on it with a wet paper towel and, you know, did all this stuff. But anyway, I tried to find him, but that was pre-internet stuff, and gave up because I wanted to, you know, ask him if I could make this chair, because I'm pretty sensitive about that stuff. At least I'm pretty sensitive about that stuff coming from that end. I'm not the least bit sensitive about that stuff coming from my end. Other people making my stuff, I could give a crap. I want them to make it. I want them to make it better. But I never could find him. And then when I got ready to do the plans, I thought, man, I really need to find this guy. I mean, this looks like his chair. And I happened to mention it to John Benson at Fine Woodworking, and John goes, oh, I love this stuff. He goes, let me go after it. And within hours, I got an email from John, and he said, I found him. He said, very interesting fella. He said he does a whole like 2-hour Mark Twain theater piece. And he's done some volunteer work in Africa, building a school for, I think, children that are blind. And I said, it's my kind of guy right here.
Yeah, I know. I was about to say, you and him are cut from the same cloth.
His chair. And so I wrote him a letter, a real letter, and just explained everything and sent him to the website. And I got this wonderful email from him, just saying, you know, I'm just thrilled that you did this chair. You know, he goes, you produce the plans, do whatever you want. He said, you know, and I'd written there, I'll be glad to put your name on the plans as, you know, designer and all of this. And he said, you do whatever you want. You can do that if you want. And of course, you know, I did. And so that's where it came from. So I was just real happy that I got in touch with him. And you know, I'd like to go visit the guy. He's in Northwest Connecticut. He's actually a town that they call the Icebox of Connecticut, Norfolk or North something. That's it's real near
Lime Rock.
No, it's real near East Canaan or Canaan, okay. However they say it. Because that's where Andy Jack, one of my apprentices, lives. He only lives about 8 miles from him. If you go from East Canaan, if you go east 8 miles and you'll go up in elevation into the mountains there, there's a little town that starts with an N, and that's where he is. But so that's
beautiful country up there.
Yeah, it is. It's really nice. And so I got those plans out, and then I've been so now I'm back to the fan back armchair plans. We've got really one of the final drafts of it done, and now I'll be building one to the plans to vet those plans. So started on it today, and that's just a lot of fun. I love doing that, building the chair to the plans, and just trying to wipe out everything in my mind that I knew before and pretending like I know nothing about this chair. It's hard to do.
I imagine, yeah.
You know, just to look at that plan every time and don't make a move without it, because you're on automatic pilot. You know, I've made so many chairs, you automatically jump in and make the spindles. But no, you need to look at every dimension in the drawing and all that. And I'm not real good at it. I miss a lot of stuff. And people, you know, really good customers remind me of it, which is what I want. You know, they'll write me and they'll go, this doesn't line up, Curtis. Crap.
Let me do a quick video post. Yeah.
Jeff wants everything to be perfect. There is no detail too small.
Yeah.
For Jeff to correct. None. Mm-hmm.
He's incredible.
It's just so good. He's just so good. And I think we make a really good pair because I'm so loose, you know, and I'm, you know, I was all in college. I was terrible about proofreading my papers. You know, I was terrible. And so this has been good with Jeff. He holds my feet to the fire with the stuff. And so I started on that, and a lot of fun. I'll be back in the shop in the morning, carve another spoon, and then I'll start turning the maple parts for this fan back armchair. And I have to get Eric, my apprentice, to mill post for me. I don't like to venture too far from the technique that I like, and what happens when you start, like Velda's chair, for instance, that you've made, Kyle. That takes me out of the way wood wants to work, and I like to stay in the realm of the way wood wants to work. So the democratic chair would be the ultimate in that, but also the continuous armchair. You know, you rive out good oak, good white oak. You shave it straight with the grain. It's green. You don't have to worry about your steam box. It doesn't matter if your steam box is at 200 or 210. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you have enough moisture in your steam box. None of that means a crap. You know, you don't have to have straps. You don't have to have anything. But as soon as you start getting out of that, and like with Velda's chair, that comb, okay, especially if I'm going to make it out of walnut, it's got to be 7/8. It's 4 inches wide. You know, you start getting into some issues there. I got to bend it with some sort of device, a strap. That means I've got to make it. It means got to have another god awful jig around the shop, which I detest. You know, but I like the chair. But I've always tried to watch that really close and not venture too far from the way wood wants to be worked. You know, Potter's chair takes me out of that a little bit. Yeah. And with this fan back armchair, I want a good joint of that arm going into that post. Like with Potter's chair, it makes sense to have a round mortise and tenon joint right there. Okay, piece of cake. You don't have to worry about that one. The Democratic chair, I do a stub tenon, and I bring in the loose tenon from the back. So that's, you know, standing proud off the back and domed and all that, that little 3/8 stub floating tenon there. And, and that works good for that chair. But for this fan back chair, I've always chopped a rectangular mortise and tenon joint there. I really wanted something strong, and I would coat the shoulders around the post. Right. So a traditional fan back armchair has a big square, what I think is a real ugly looking feature right there. You know, it's a real big chair anyway, but it has this, you know, this big square that's right there where this big giant serpentine arm comes into it. And the arm is cut in a V in the back and fits over one of the corners and is nailed onto the post. And I didn't like anything about that. So I sleeked it up and made a sleek round post right there and then brought the arm into it in a more slender serpentine. And then it coped around that post. But that cope is like impossible, or at least impossible for me. You know, you just fiddle with it and fiddle with it and fiddle with it. And then you end up with something that you finally got to say, okay, I'll fill that crack right there and I'm gonna paint it, you know, and it's okay.
Yeah.
Jeff suggested that I do a double tenon like he does on the ladder backs that he's doing where the front rail comes across into the post. And that's a Boggs thing there. And I knew about it whenever, Brian and I, as you probably know, worked together for, I mean, we didn't work together in a shop, but we were together a lot, especially in Honduras and everything. And so I saw that joint when he developed it, but I never thought about putting it there. But then at first I discounted it because the post didn't have enough meat. But the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. And if I added maybe just a little bit of dimension to the post and maybe just brought down that arm to 3/4, it could work. So we redesigned that joint, but I've never made one with it. Mm-hmm. And so this would be the trial run for it. On paper, it works great, you know, but you don't have to cope, you know. Yeah. Now, you have to cut 2/4-inch tenons, 1/4-inch by 3/4, but they can only be a 1/2-inch deep just because of the diameter of that post. But that's going to be plenty strong. You got four, you know, shoulders there on that thing.
Yeah.
So I think it's plenty strong. So anyway, that's going to be, you know, a lot of fun doing it. But the only way to do that I can think of is the stock. You know, I use all split stock, all my maple right. split stock. I don't saw my oak, and I don't saw my maple either. There's a difference. There's a difference. And so all I've got is just firewood looking stuff down there at the shop. and I don't have any method to make anything square. And not only do I don't have any method, I don't have any skill to make anything square. The square stuff I've tried to make in my life is wonky. I can't, years ago, I did it 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. I've got some pieces that I made that aren't bad, but I can't do it anymore. And, you know, I made a little box to put a friend of mine's ashes in. He asked me to make him a pine box when he was getting ready to pass away. And I said, Walter, I don't make boxes, man. I make chairs. You know, make a box. So, okay, so make a box. And I measured as close as I could. And this was a little 12 by 12 by 12 box. And the lid would only fit one way. I think I was like a 16th of an inch off. I couldn't do it. And I really tried too, you know, it's terrible. And so anyway, so Eric, my apprentice that I've got with me right now, Eric Conasaro, he's great. Great, by the way. Absolutely.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He has beautiful work.
I'm going to miss him when he leaves. And it's so bad. So sad. He's been here through COVID because we really don't work together. You know, he comes in the shop. He was in the shop this morning. We're both masked, and we have great conversation. And he set up a shop outside for the summer, and he worked out there just right underneath one of my roofs. But anyway, but it's been good. So anyway, this morning I told Eric, can you mail me two pieces of maple of the split stock that we've got? And so he said, yeah, so he'll get that milled for me. And then I'll chop the mortises while it's square and then turn it. Mm-hmm. And I've done that before. When I was in the past Fanback armchairs that I've done, even with that one mortise, one time I chopped it when it was square. I couldn't say it was square, but at least gave it a flat surface to chop into. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up chopping it after I've rounded it, which, of course, as you all probably know, has its own issues. You know, you got those real thin edges up there of that mortise that can break off real easy.
Yeah, that was going to be my question was, yeah, when you're trying to turn that with them already chopped, that's got to be a delicate operation right there where the mortise is. Yeah.
You know, I've never seen, you know, when I've turned it with that, I've the tools never, ever picked up anything that anything's there. It just sings right over it.
That kind of makes sense because when you're squaring, you know, when you're rounding square stock, yeah, very rarely do you get a big blowout on something like that. So yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. Yeah. It's just something I've never done. I've never turned a mortise.
And I hadn't done a lot of it. So, yeah. And I've done it in a number of years. So we'll see, you know, we'll see what it does, but that's not a concern of mine because I didn't see any issue with it. So yeah, that's all interesting and fun. And I mean, just turning that post alone challenges me.
Yeah. I'm looking at that post. That's a pretty thin post, especially up there.
Yeah, it's a half inch, and it's 30 inches long.
Yeah.
So whenever you're roughing it out, it'll climb up your roughing out gouge before you can blink your eye and snap. I mean, oh my God. And so it's the only turning that I have to use a steady rest on. The Fanback side chair is 22 inches long and it goes down to a half, but if everything's humming right, I can turn it. I hate to use a steady rest cause it's a bother. And I used to use one. I had one for years, a good one. I bought a good one. It was made by, Sorby.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I used it for years and my results were so-so with it. Mm-hmm. And then, Eric was the artist in residence down at Aramont, and they closed because of COVID, and he moved up here to town in April because of that. But they got rid of some stuff and gave it to Eric, and Eric gave me this one-way steady rest, which is you all probably familiar with. It's got big old wheels on it.
That's the one I have, yeah.
It's like rubber tires.
Yep.
And I thought, well, let's try that thing. Well, there's a big difference. that's a really good steady rest. And I realized that my other one must have been just loosening up with me just a little bit, which was causing the problem. This one stays really tight and runs nice. And it was really a pleasure using it. Still a bother.
Yeah.
But it was a pleasure, especially because of the results I was getting, and I was able to turn it all with a skew, with it, which thrills me. So that's, you know, I always look forward to challenge. I mean, I look forward to turning just the same baluster turning that I've turned forever, because pulling it off with the crispness and the clarity that I want, just with that skew chisel, always pushes me. You know, you can never take that for granted, even though I've turned 20 some thousand of them probably. I still have to just get my head right and tool right and everything right to pull that thing off at the level that I want.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine. And is that the world famous train we hear in the background?
That is the train coming through about 10 times a day.
Well, that's fantastic.
That's good. You can hear that.
It brings me back. I always love that in your videos when the train comes through.
Right. that and the wren.
Yeah.
The wren and the courthouse clock sometimes.
Clock, yeah, the clock. Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
oh, Well, these last few chairs you've done, I mean, yeah, some of this joinery is just fantastic and intricate. You know, I can't wait to see this this arm back post joint, and you know, like Petria's chair, that that false miter up there is just exquisite the way that's done there.
No, very, thanks. Very. Well, that, well, I was kind of forced to come up with that. But when I did it, the first 15, I think, first Potter got 10 of them, and then I think five chairs after that, I did them with a round tenon on the end, much like you would do the birdcage false miter. Mm-hmm. And they started breaking. The cone started shearing. It's kind of hard to explain how it would shear, but every one of them would break the same way. Right around that tenon. I was taking away the tenon being round, you know, takes up more space for less strength than that rectangular Morrison tenon does. And then I was cutting away too much out of that comb. And, you know, you're reminded of what Simon Watts said, that he always guaranteed his furniture for life, but it looked like the second half of his life was going to be spent repairing what he made the first half. And, God, boy, did that ring true with that. I had all 15 of them didn't break, but I bet 7 or 8 of them did. And mm-hmm. That's a major repair. That's cutting that whole top off of that thing, redoing it, and matching the paint. You know, you just, and you're working for free. You just don't want to be doing that. And so I went over that joint and bounced it off of, you know, different woodworkers at the time. That's when Brian and I were doing a lot of work together and bouncing off of him. And, you know, you're looking up, you know, maybe the sugar maple. Let's look up shear strength. And in Hoadley's book, only shagbark hickory ranks higher in shear strength than sugar maple does. So, okay, that's not the problem. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's stronger in the tangential plane than it is in the radial plane. Maybe I need to switch it. Maybe I need to flip it around. And you know, that's not true. So I ended up adding, I think, a 16th to the comb and a 16th to the post, took out a little less material, and then made a joint that was a chopped mortise and sawn tenon. And the face of that tenon is even with the center of the post. So the tenon is on the back side of that post. So you can carve, or you'd carve into it, mm-hmm. and getting as long as you can. 5/8 was the length that I could get. And you know, it's worked. It's been all those repairs. None of them have come back. And, the other 20 some chairs that I've made since then, I've never seen back. And I've got the same look pretty much,
mm-hmm.
but a good joint. And,
yeah. Yeah, that's a fabulous joint there. Now, a question, since we're kind of talking about some of your chairs, any chance you're ever going to make some plans for the Mantis armchair?
I
love your contemporary designs. I really do.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
And that's one. A few years ago, I was thinking about chairs. Windsor chairs, and a bunch of people are doing, well, they're still doing it, but some of those Danish cord weaves. I'm going, I wonder how a woven back would be. And then I went, oh, wait, Curtis already has one of those.
Yeah. And you know, that chair came out of this inspiration, with Greenwood, the Greenwood project that I helped start. Scott Landis and Brian Boggs and me started in 92. And we worked on the coast of Honduras, but right around 2000, 2001, 2002, we started working with a tribe in the Peruvian Amazon, the central Amazon of Peru, called the Yanesha, which, interesting, it's where Scott started in about 87. With the Yanesha, and they were trying to sustainably harvest their forest at that time. And now we found ourselves, you know, 13, 14 years later, back down there working with them. And we all three, it was the only time that we've ever, all three of us, had been on a trip together. And Brian was going to run the project, But I went down for the first trip just to kind of help with just ideas, you know, because it's pretty tough. You're thrown. It's pretty crude conditions. But we watched them work for a while, and then we started working with them. And what started coming to mind was they had slabs of a wood that was interlocking grain. I forget the name of it. And they were carving bowls with adzes. So I went, well, shoot, right there, we got a seat, you know.
Yeah.
We got a slab with interlocking grain, and they got an adze, and they can chop it out. I said, I mean, that's all you need for a Windsor chair is a seat. Yeah. Everything else is fluff. You know? It just goes into the seat, and the seat holds it all together. So shoot, we got to start. We're going to run with this thing. And so then I started thinking about, you know, a lot of water there, boats and everything. So I was thinking of a boat for that seat. And so that's where that kind of seat shape came from, was boats. And then the other thing that's real prevalent down there are insects, you know, snakes, but it's not worked in, but insects. And so I started thinking about these insects and this interlocking grain wood. And how I could do away with stretchers if I had some really strong piece of wood like that, and make it thicker and all this sort of stuff. And then for the back, we had found some bark that seemed like it would work, and they wove some baskets and some other stuff out of that. So they had those skills. So it was really looking at them, seeing the skills that they had, the tools that they had, and what was their environment like. And I got real excited about the chair. We built one just right there, just with nothing, just winging it as we went. And when I got back, I started building prototypes and got more interested in it for myself. But I've still never made many of those chairs. I've never really shown them, you know, and I've only made a few of the armchairs, and I don't have any of them. I've sold them. But yeah, I'd like to, I mean, I've still got a lot of chairs that I haven't had Jeff draw the plans on. Now I'm worrying that we're both, you know, we're going to die before I get these things drawn, but that's okay. I'll be finished. If I die, I'm finished. Everything's done and it's okay. I wanted to get this Fanback armchair out, and, I've got, you know, a couple of riding armchairs. I've still got quite a few others that I hadn't put out, but I'd like to get to the mantis chair. Yeah, and that's why I called it the mantis chair. I called it the 10 tool chair at first, kind of like what I called the Democratic chair, although this was before the Democratic chair, because once again, you're working down there, and the Democratic chair came out of Honduras.
Yeah,
you know, you're trying to figure out what's the least that you can build this with. And there's this great quote. I meant to look it up before I was on this interview, so I could say this quote like I you know, sounded like I knew something. But I first heard it in a Patagonia film called Il Pescatore, which is an Italian fly fisherman. They're up in the Alps with him, and this guy's using nothing. I mean, he's using nothing. And the Patagonia fellow, what's his name? Chenard? What is that guy's name? Anyway, obviously he's a fly fisherman, and he's just amazed what this guy's doing with his fly with no special equipment or anything. And he makes the quote that the ultimate is not the next tool. The ultimate is the least amount that you can get it done with. And, you know, and that's without me knowing that quote, that's always kind of driven me. And anytime I've got off of that, I haven't felt that's the path that I should be on. With some pressures off of me now, you know, as kids are grown and gone and everything, you're feeling like you can maybe concentrate. I've never ventured too far from it, but you concentrate just a little more on that philosophy that you've had for so long. And the Democratic chair is you know, it's not only for somebody who doesn't have access to a lot of tools, and it's not only for people who really need to learn how to use their draw knife instead of picking up their next, you know, fancy tool that they've bought. But it's for me. You know, it's as much for me as it is for anybody else. I love the simplicity of making that chair, the simplicity of the tool that's made, the tool that you're using, and the simple forms and all of that. I just I can't get enough of making it, and
it's absolutely fantastic. And what surprises me is, you know, I peruse Instagram on a pretty much daily basis, and it seems like almost every other Windsor chair out there is the Democratic chair being built.
I love that. I mean, I love it. I want it. Yeah. I mean, it deserves it. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, I want it to be the Democratic chair. I want to give birth to it and let it go. And hopefully that's what it's done. It doesn't have to be associated with my name, and they don't have to make it the way I make it or look like it. It's just, it's this philosophy that's there. And like I said, not only this philosophy of simplicity, but this philosophy of learn how to use at least one tool, you know.
Right.
Really learn how to use it and learn what this tool can do. And you'll never learn how to use it if you don't take it past the point of diminishing returns. If you're always stopping short because you're afraid and you're switching over to the next tool, which might be a spoke shave or something, you're probably doing it too early. You know, put that tool away and pretend you don't even own it. And do everything with that draw knife. And then you'll learn what the draw knife can really do. And you'll know where that point of diminishing returns is. And you will have advanced that point and pushed it. And your work will be much better. It will be much more enjoyable. It will be much more efficient. All the above, you know.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great point. Just fabulous. And I love too how everyone has picked it up. And you know, if I ever get back to building chairs, I definitely am going to build one of those.
It's a big if.
A big F. I got to get this rocker out of the way first, and then unfortunately, a friend of mine's going to retire, and I promised him a rocker too. So, but we'll see. We'll see how that goes. But I want to back up just for a second. And so, you know, I think folks that know you know that you kind of basically stumbled into chair making. Once you found it, you've never left. So what time did you actually start making chairs? Around late 70s, early 80s?
Early 80s. Yeah.
Early 80s.
Yeah. I was 30. When I started making them, I'd been a carpenter and I was just sticking with the carpentry. It's not that I didn't like it. I did. I liked the carpentry. There was things I didn't like about it. One is it's rough on you. It's rough, dangerous, and it's rough. And, you know, you just get beat up, all the time. I fell off a floor, just right about that time and fell down in between the wall down between the basement wall and the clay wall, scraping my face on the way down and hit the bottom and was kind of knocked out. And I heard Rodney going, Curtis. And I'm crumpled down at the bottom and clay's jammed up into one eye. And I go over to the fire hall and I wash up looking at the mirror. And I just said, you know, you're 29 years old. And you're going to bounce back from this with no problem. But what about when you're 50 years old? What about when you're 60 years old? What about 30 years of this falling off of this stuff? And I didn't have anything else going on. And we moved down. We live in Western North Carolina near Asheville, and moved down the mountain after my wife just about wrecked driving up the mountain in the snow. We were living up in a little cabin on a creek, which I just loved. And
I've driven through there before, and you know that part of the country. And yeah, even when it's dry, some of those switchbacks and stuff are fairly dangerous, especially when you're a tourist and you're not on this, and everybody in the neighborhood's driving right behind you at about 50 miles an hour, and you're going, I can barely go 20.
Yeah, we live right under the Blue Ridge Parkway, and and she comes in and she goes, in the morning you will find us a place to live at the bottom of this mountain. And that's exactly what I did the next morning, is I found this little farmhouse down there. But you never know, all these little tiny decisions that you make, and they've been momentous in your life. There was next door was an old fellow that had a shop behind his house. He was a retired cabinet maker, but he'd go out to his shop every day and work. And I started working with him, and I liked the work, but I hated the machines. I just detested them. The planer, I just couldn't stand running boards through the planer and the table saw, and I hated it worse when we had to work on one of them or repair it. Mm-hmm. I loved cutting the dovetails. I liked turning on his lathe. And so about that time, I had Drew's book, Country Woodcraft, that just got republished by Lost Art Press. And I'd bought it for a penny at one of these book club things.
Wow.
Drew and I are good buddies. He might sign it one day. I think he used to sign it back in the 80s, because I only paid a penny for it. But I got it when he signed up for one of these clubs, and you know, Country Woodcraft. Oh, that sounds good. So I got it, and I had never seen anything like this before. This was not what I was expecting. And I actually put it to the side. And then summer of 82, or a little bit later on, it was actually November, is my birthday, my 30th birthday, Marilyn bought me Roy Underhill's first book. And we didn't have a television, so I hadn't seen him, but I'd heard about him, and gave me his first book. And I just about slept with that thing. So Roy's book didn't necessarily tell you how to do anything. Drew's book told you how to do it. But it didn't really inspire me that much.
Yeah.
Roy's book didn't tell you how to do it, but it inspired me. So I put the two together.
Yeah.
Two together, and had a shaving horse built and draw knife, and I was bending wood, and I was trying to build some ladder backs and pitchforks. And I said, man, this is great. I love this, but what can I make to make a living at? You know, and I didn't have Brian's vision with the ladder back, because I looked at those as being, you know, the Woodies down the road were making factory ladder backs for, you know, $100. And I didn't see how I could do that. So I ran across Windsor Chairs, which would have been that next year, summer of 83. And I started trying to make them, and there was nothing out there, nothing written, nothing available at all. And I was just trying to I'd go around and talk to woodworkers. Anybody that had a shop to me was like a master woodworker, you know. Uh-huh. And now I look back on some of the things some of them said, and I thought, oh my God. You know? but you know, for me at that time, it, you know, if you had a shop, you knew what you were doing. And but nobody knew about Windsor's. And so I made all these parts, and I started trying to put it together. And it just happened that Dave Sawyer was spending the summer at Drew Langsner's place. And Dave had come down to the Asheville Mall to try to sell some chairs. And Max Woody, one of the Woody chair makers, had passed through the mall and seen Dave and invited him down to his shop. And Max knew I was trying to make Windsors. So Max invited me down. And that would have probably been June of 83. And I went down to meet Dave, and I knew of Dave from Fine Woodworking, you know. And so Dave was the first person, not only that I'd ever met that made Windsors, but the first person that said, oh, you can make Windsor chairs. You know, they're not hard. And he gave me five pieces of paper 8.5 by 11 with each one of them had a complete chair on it. And that's Dave, you know, that is Dave. He's not going to waste any paper on anything. And it was a continuous arm, a fan back, a cone back, a sack back, and a loop back. And, you know, little chair pattern on it and angles written on it and all this trig all over the place. Yeah. And I thought, oh, my God. He said, here you go. And then he said, we're putting together a fan back up at Drew's place. You come up on Wednesday and I'll show you how to put the undercarriage together. And well, you know, Drew to me was like God, you know, I owned a book by this guy. I didn't know where he lived, but he'd written a book and, so I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to Drew's. And, so I left early in the morning and, it was about an hour from where I was going. Cause you know, Drew's right on the Tennessee line. And, in fact, I live closer to him now that we're in Tennessee than I did when I lived in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And, but I drove up there and as much as I like to talk and tell stories, I believe I might've uttered a word or two that day, but not much. I just sat over to the side and watched Dave teach Drew how to put this undercarriage together.
Uh-huh.
And I went back and started making chairs. They were bad. I know one of your questions there was, what about your first chair? Oh Lord, the first chair, I gave it to a guy and told him he couldn't tell where he got it from. His name was Smiley. His name was Smiley. I don't remember his real name, but his name was Smiley. Wow. And so I made a bunch of really bad chairs. And then come winter, I just literally locked myself in the shop and just started making chairs because I decided if I'm going to learn during the summer, I was still making some furniture trying to sell it. Mm-hmm. But by December, I decided that I'm not going to learn how to make these chairs unless this is all I do. So there's too much here. And I devoted all my time to it. And I finally came out of there, out of the shop with 5 chairs. I still got one down at the shop. It's bad too. But 5 chairs that all 5 of them were terrible. But but they, you know, I'd still never seen a Windsor chair.
Right.
I'd never seen one. I'd seen the pictures in magazines. Mm-hmm. But that was it. And I went to the Asheville Mall where Dave had been for a show late February, and I had 5 chairs and I set them there. And I had to sell something. I had to bring some money home. I hadn't brought any in months now. And nobody stopped. Oh, they might stop and look, say something, but nobody bought. And I was packing up. It was Sunday night. I was packing up. And this couple was walking by with some packages. And they walked right past me, and then they turned around, and they came back. And they ended up ordering 6 chairs, and they gave me a check for $500 down payment, and which was huge. And I remember every mile of driving back down the mountain to Marion, where we lived. I was so excited, and they came in the house and threw that check. Marilyn was already in bed and threw that check on the bed. I said, somebody ordered chairs. I said, leave it. And
we're rich.
That's what got me started. And I've never lost the enthusiasm for them. And you know, maybe it's because I don't require much to keep me occupied. But I always thought that I would get these chairs under my belt. And then I would start adding some casework back to it. And after probably 4 or 5 years, I realized that I would never do casework again. It didn't interest me anymore at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the chairs, I mean, I still can't wait to get down to the shop, and Marilyn still has to pull me out of the shop because I like it so much. And I can't believe that I serendipitously landed into this thing. And and then being able to make a living from it and being able to do what I've done with it was the furthest thing from my mind. It wasn't what I thought of in my wildest dreams. And still, I would still been happy just making a few chairs for customers and nobody knowing who I was at all, because I just like, you know, I like using a draw knife. I like sitting on a shaving horse. I love the split in the wood. I love the smell of it. You know, I just like that whole simple kind of organic process, right, that green woodworking, you know, is. And I think we're all pushed. We all get pushed up against the limitations of our hand tools. And with green woodworking, you get pushed in up to against the limitations of green wood and working green wood and all the inconsistencies with it and all that. And we want to control things more. And so we inch just a little bit further and just a little bit further. And before you know it, you know, we're trying to control it more and we're trying to air dry it before we bend it. So it's going to, you know, all of that. And when I find myself going in that direction over the years, I always rein myself back in, and because it's not where I want to go. And some people, it's fine. I mean, you see where Boggs is gone. He just got a big giant monster CNC machine that's the size of a tractor trailer truck. I mean, literally, it's the size of a tractor trailer truck, and he's all excited about it, but that stuff didn't interest me. And so every time, I mean, buying that bandsaw was the last thing I did that drew me away from the tools that I loved. I love sawing out my seats with my bow saw. I got good with it and I made one chair a week at that time. I don't make that now, but at that time I made one chair a week. It took me 15 minutes to saw it out with that bow saw. I always looked forward to it. It was a workout.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought the bandsaw to clip ends off of mainly the hard maple billets, the turnings, you know, because doing it with a handsaw was really grunt work. And so I picked up this old Delta for that. And the next chair that I had to make, I wasn't even thinking. I got the seat blank prepped and drew out the pattern and reached over and picked up my bandsaw. And I still remember that moment. And I looked at the band, I mean, picked up my bow saw. Picked up my bow saw. And I looked over at the band saw. Shit. I said, I can't saw it out with the bow saw anymore. Band saw. Damn, I didn't look at that. I said, you better pay attention from now on what you buy and what you give away. Because now you've just given away your use of the bow saw. You'll never use it again. And the only time I've ever used it is when the bandsaw was down, and I picked it up, and I've always remembered that and always tried to think of what I'm bringing in this shop and what I'm doing in this shop and the repercussions that it's going to have that are unforeseen. Sure, maybe it makes sense on this level, but what's it going to do here? Is it going to take away being a woodworker, you know? When does that stop? Where is that line where the woodworking stops and the machinist begins? And I want to stay as far away from that as I possibly can. And once again, I'm not judging anybody who does it any differently. I'm just saying, trying to understand yourself.
Right.
And what it is that you want and what makes you happy, and that decisions that you make and unbeknownst to you will take you in the other direction. And before you know it, you're looking back going, well, it sure was nice back then. And I don't want that. I don't want to ever have to say that.
Well, what other power tools do you have in your shop? You have the bandsaw, and I guess you got a lathe, and that's probably about it.
I have a lathe. I have a lathe. I've always turned on a power lathe.
I was about to say, have you ever turned on like a treadle lathe or
pole lathe? I turn on pole lathes a lot. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we taught on pole lathes in Honduras all the time.
That's what I figured. Yeah.
Oh yeah. 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 We had it down to where we could build a pole lathe out of, you wouldn't believe what we built them out of and hung them off of. I mean, we weren't trying to build poles that turned nice bowls and nesting bowls and all this stuff. We were trying to build poles that turned tenons, because that is the best way to get an accurate tenon. Is a lathe. That's hands down. There's nothing else that touches it. You can do a tenon a lot of different ways, but the simplest, most accurate way is to build a pole, even if you're down in the remote tropics. It is the best way of doing it. And so we put those things together fast, but I never got good with one, you know, at all. But when I was building my shop, I worked in, for 10 years, I worked in different places. And then for the last 4 years of that, I was in the basement of my house. We'd built a house in 89, and I worked in the basement from 89 to about 93. So I'd worked in enough places to know what I wanted in a shop. And, you know, I knew certainly by that time that I didn't want to make anything else except for Greenwood chairs. And that I would, that I wouldn't have anything else in the shop besides any other power tool besides the bandsaw and the lathe. And, that really opens up the possibilities for a small shop. And, you know, I used to make a joke about it, but it's not, I'm really serious about it. And it was where people would always tell me, well, think when you get ready to build your shop, think of the biggest shop that you ever need and then double it. And I always thought, you know what you ought to do? You ought to think of the smallest shop you could possibly get by with and then cut it in half. It's kind of like going on a backpacking trip, you know, and everything is within reach. Nothing can come down to the shop that can't pay its way. You know, if a broken lamp from the house comes down to the shop, it's got to be fixed that day. I don't have a corner to put it in. I don't have a place to put it. You know, everything in there has to work and has to go towards making chairs. That's it. And, I don't know where I was going with that. I actually had a goal.
Get what it was.
Okay. Ask me another question.
One thing that was interesting, you talk about you've only built chairs. Now, I know you've had hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of commissions for chairs. Now, did any of those people come to you and say, hey, I want a dining table and chairs? And if so, did you have someone that you worked with to build the table portion of it or what?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of people ask me to build a table. In fact, I got an email from a lady the other day saying, you built chairs for us a long time ago. Would you make us a table? Just the other day. and of course, the answer is always no, I don't make tables, and you don't want me to make your table. And I send them to somebody else.
I didn't know if you had friends and stuff like that you worked with. So it sounds like you did. So that
no, I mean, I don't have anybody I don't have anybody in particular.
Okay.
No, none of that. Never that organized. And then now I don't, you know, I don't even really, I stopped taking orders for chairs quite a long time ago. Officially, I took an order the other day for a rocker, Velda's rocker, because a lady wrote me this real sweet letter from Atlanta saying she was pregnant with their first child, and they had looked and looked and looked, and they had watched me online on the videos, and she wrote all the right stuff, you know.
So you're telling the world you're the key to getting a Curtis chair is you got to have a nice letter.
Lady, she really wants this rocker. I told Marilyn, I said, I can't bear to write her back and tell her I don't take commissions anymore. I said, I'm just going to go ahead and tell her I'll make it. And So I see if I can make it by this summer. I just can't get chairs made the way that I used to anyway, and I don't need to. Working to those orders was wonderful for years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the way I worked. I loved it, it was never any pressure on me. I told the people they would get their chairs whenever I would get to it. My girls were young. I needed, to know that I had income coming in, all of that stuff. Everything was good. I couldn't, there's not one complaint I have about any of that, but things change as you go along, and lots of things change. You change, the economy changes, people's tastes change, what's going on inside your house changes, and so all that affects your work. And so there's been changes that we've had. One big change that we had is my wife Marilyn, who's, we've been married 43 years, I guess, from the time she
congratulations
went. Better get that right.
Let's see, 1978. I remember that. So
it'd be cool. Oh, that's easy. That's the year I was born. It's 42.
42.
So 42 years. And but she had a non-symptomatic stroke 18 years ago, which partially paralyzed her right side. And that's huge life changing for all of us. And it was difficult for me to keep up making these chairs to commission, because I wasn't able to get this consistent work in that I'd always gotten in. Always, at that time, girls were in school. I'd take them down to the bus at 7 o'clock in the morning. They'd get on the bus. I'd walk straight down to the shop. I'd be in the shop at 7. By 12 o'clock, I'd gotten a day's work done. It was great. And, but all that changed. And, So I struggled to get enough time, and, momentum would be knocked out. I would have to come up to the house. Marilyn's amazing. She just continues just to push and push and push. And she cooks up a storm with one arm. You wouldn't believe what she does with one hand. amazing. Puts us to shame, I tell you that. And, but she still needs, some help. And, so I'm coming up to the shop, and things aren't, frustrations building because I'm not getting these chairs made. And that's when we switched to, teaching. I'd already been teaching for years, not only at schools, but also I'd been teaching one person at a time once a month in the shop. But it was a real laid back thing, and I'd been doing it since the mid-80s. And it was just easy. You want to come, pay me when you get here, tell me what you want to make, and you can make it, and I'll just continue working on whatever. If they didn't show up, that was fine too. I got, so I didn't rely on it. And then I thought, okay, if we can gear up for, 6 to 8 weeks a year for classes, and I can rearrange the shop, put some porches on it to where we can handle 3 students, then that can be our income. And the rest of the time, if I get work done, I get it done. And that worked fine. In fact, it worked great. I was full with classes. It was fun. And then COVID hits,
Yeah.
And so it's like, who would have thought that? And that's of course what we're all saying. It's like, oh my God. It takes us a while to finally face the reality of it. And the reality by, I canceled my April classes in March, but still holding on like a lot of people. And then finally, April, I went, this is nuts. I mean, I think I saw the newsletter from Peter Korn from Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. And Peter just said, we're canceling our classes. And I looked, said, he's right. He's right. And so I canceled them, and I said, okay, what are we going to do now?
Now what?
Yeah. So I had, I probably had 7 or 8 chairs hanging around the house that were for sale, but I'd never really pushed them. So I actively pushed them and sold them. Planned sales doubled.
Yep.
People were home. That was huge. That was just huge. And then started, selling the, spoons. And, then Alia wanted me to teach a little bit with him online. So all of a sudden here we're sitting fine.
Yeah. You're doing a bunch of stuff with him. Y'all have the, pay as you go plan. I think you got a you have what, the spoon class with Alia?
Yeah.
In that, and as well as a couple of plants, I think a stool and the Democratic chair. And
yeah, just we didn't do a stool. We did Democratic chair. We did 7 sessions with it.
Yeah.
That's
not a pay as you go. That's or pay what you can. It's more of a strict online class. But
it is pay what you can.
Oh, it is? Oh, yes. I didn't know that one was too. Oh, okay.
It is pay what you can. Okay. And the film that you can still go to and pull up is still pay what you can.
I knew the spoon one was, but I didn't realize the Democratic chair one was too. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah,
it is. And, it's worked out good. It's just like the Democratic chair plans. And that was my son-in-law that came up with that, my genius son-in-law. he's great. And when I was, doing this chair, it was reviving this chair that I'd done in the 90s in Honduras that nobody wanted to make. I mean, when I taught it in Honduras, I thought, this is the chair everybody ought to be making. So I came back here, and I was teaching at the time. And I said, okay, from now on, if you come to me or if I go teach at some school, this is what you're making, because the rest of it's nuts. It's crazy for somebody who's never made a chair to come in and make, these continuous arm chairs and sack backs. And sure, we can get them through the class, but it's overwhelming. And, and they don't learn. What they need to do is learn something. Yeah, I need to learn how to, nobody wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So you can't make a living if nobody wants to do it.
Do it.
So like I say, you just hang the red light out and say, okay, what you gonna make? I'll teach you anything you want. Then a few years ago, just happened to jump back in my mind and I went, you know what? I said, I bet time's right for that chair. Yeah. I said, with all this spoon carving going on, I said, the time's right. It has matured enough. Green woodworking with the hobbyist has matured enough to where this chair's going to, going to go. I didn't know it was going to go like it went, but that's when I revived it. And that's when I decided it had to be called something. So I stole that name from Bill Copperthwaite and his Democratic Tools or borrowed it. I was putting all these videos up, or I was going to put the videos up. Fine Woodworking wanted to shoot them, and Ben Strano, I guess he's the guy who does their videos. Ben said, can we, Fine Woodworking is interested in shooting. Ben's a good fella. I only met him once at Greenwood Fest, but he's a real good guy. And I don't think so. And when he went back and told Benson, Benson said, yeah, Curtis wants to give it away. and that's true in a certain sense and not in a certain sense too. Yeah. I mean, I have to make a living too and sell stuff. But with this chair, I just felt it was different. And I felt that I wanted to put those videos up and give it away. And then when it came to the plans, my son-in-law said, Curtis, you ought to put up the digital files too, and just have people just pay what they want for it. Mm. And I thought, boy, that's right, Russell. That's exactly what ought to happen. And there have been hundreds and hundreds. I don't know how many people have made chairs from those digital files, but there are hundreds of people that have gotten it. And, and quite a few give something.
And probably sometime you're surprised. I didn't know they were going to give that much.
There are some surprises
The community's great in that way. And I think I'd be remiss without mentioning all the videos you have out there on YouTube. I just want to say thank you so much for those videos because they're out there for free. And I mean, there are many people that would have charged quite a bit of money for those videos. They are fantastic and a constant resource. I mean, You know, I know I've watched every one of them at least once, and I'm sure there are a few of those I've watched at least 400 or 500 times. As I'm going through some sort of thing, going, wait, how is this done? Let me go back to the video.
Yeah, I don't think you can limit your generosity just to the Democratic chair, because for years you were like the source of all the best bootleg chair plans. Like, I think I have two or three sets of plans from Greg Pennington that he got from you. And I know you let Kyle make a copy of the Velda's chair plans and send them to me before you had the plans for sale.
Oh, okay.
So thanks for that, too.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know, I was just trying to just pass on what Dave did for me. And I always gave my plans away, always did. And then finally I started, you know, selling them, of course, but I still give away, you know, like there's Russell Stuhl, and Russell Stuhl is actually from Mosier, and I've probably will never put out the plans for Russell Stuhl, because it is really Mosier's. I mean, you know, I didn't look at Mosier Stuhl and copy it or anything, but I saw a picture of Mosier Stuhl and I went, boy, I love that low back, and that low back makes that stool. Without that low back, it's not Mosher's; it's just a Windsor stool. But with that low back on it, that it's got, you know, that he modeled after a 1949 Indian motorcycle, I think. See, is where he got that from. It's just beautiful, and that low angle that it comes into the seat is beautiful. And I'd like to put out the plans, but I've never asked Mosier if I could do it, and I wouldn't do it unless he let me do it. But I have people all the time wanting to do that. So many of them that I finally copied the plans down and got it on my computer to where I can just send it to them instead of having to go back down to the shop and write it down. But yeah, it's just the generosity that Dave showed, and you know, Dave said early on, I said, well, are you worried about all these other people that are going to make Windsor chairs? This was, you know, 1984 when I finally went up to work with him, and Dave looked at me, said, I'm not worried about that. He goes, there's enough work for everybody. And, you know, and I just have kept that right on the front of my brain ever since then. Anytime there's a question, anytime that you feel a little bit of like competition pressure or something like this, you just say, hold on a second. There's enough work for everybody out there. Don't worry about it. And you feel so much better. Now you don't have to worry about it, you know, which is huge. That's the biggest part of it right there. You're worried about it, you know? You're worried about, you know, you see one of your chair designs somewhere and you're worried that somebody stole that chair design. Well, don't worry about it. And it's not a problem.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what first got us talking about you coming on the episode was we saw that this Russian website was selling your Democratic chair. For like $270 US. I don't know what shipping was, but and it was a picture of your Democratic chair. I don't know if the actual chair you get looks like the picture, but
I'm not sure. You know, I showed it to my youngest daughter and her husband, and they were blowing it up, and Eric, and they were all three on it trying to figure out if this was actually a chair or if this was some composite somebody computerized or something. I don't know. Right. I didn't know what they were talking about, but I was kind of intrigued and also flattered. It's like, look at that. That's just, that's just great. So,
I'm very tempted just to order one to see what shows up.
Yeah, it was 200 and something dollars or something like that.
Yeah, it's like $270, but like I said, I don't know what shipping was, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see what you actually received. Yeah,
it would be.
Probably you and Jeff's plans and some wood.
Right. Maybe so. You know,
maybe there was a draw knife.
Somebody sent me a link to, it's like Ted's Woodworking, you know. So you guys know about this. Said they're showing your plans on here. And so I go, what is this? So I click on this, and this was a few years back, and I click on it, and here's this guy, kind of lumberjack looking guy, you know, with a flannel shirt on, and, you know, real tough guy, you know, with an axe, you know, Ted's Woodworking, you know, it's coming out of probably, you know, Vietnam or something. And and sure enough, there's my plans on there. And then I start looking, and it's, you know, it's a CD with 60,000 plans, and it's I'm saying, what is this crap? And finally, I went, oh my God. I said, this is nothing. It's nothing to bother me, you know, and there's nothing you can do about it anyway. And why would you want to waste the energy trying to do something about that? So,
Well, that's true. Well, speaking of that, is there anything, what's next for you? Anything you want to promote or tell the folks about what's upcoming? I guess we got the new chair plans you're working on, but anything after that?
Fan back armchair plans that I'm working on, and probably next would be, as far, you know, the plans is where I'm putting my energies now. I really enjoy it. I like working with Jeff. I like building chairs to them, and they're selling. So people like them. So the Democratic Rocker probably, and Democratic Barstool and Democratic Settee are all on, you know, online. It takes me a long time to do these things. So,
I'm catching a theme here.
Yeah. Well, I figured I'd run with this Democratic thing. You know, it's doing well.
Yeah. Well, the Settee is interesting because I'm not sure there are a lot of plans out there for Settees.
Yeah, and you know, I've avoided the Settees because of just the paper. You know, how do you get this thing on the paper? But Jeff's up for giving it a try, and so I guess the Democratic Settee might be the first one. And you know, when I first started putting these things out, I mean, you know, I can back up. I had no plans to ever put out chair plans, and it all came from these videos, and I know that maybe some people have looked at those videos and thought, you know, this guy's nuts for giving away all this information. But the way that all that started out was my neighbor, Gary, was building a chair with me. And he had cataract surgery and lost the sight in one eye during the time when he was building his chair. And they tried to save it, and they had a bubble over it. And it took a whole year for all this rigmarole to take place. And finally, took the bubble off and saw that he'd lost the sight, and a retina was detached. And a few months passed, and I asked Gary if he was ever going to come back down and finish his chair. And he said, well, Curtis, I know I need to pay you for the work I've done with you. Well, I couldn't grab a club big enough to hit him with at that point. It ain't what I'm talking about, Gary. Yeah. You want to finish your chair?
Yeah.
And he said, well, I don't know if I can. And I said, well, let's give it a try. So as he was finishing it up, I started talking about this thing I'd heard about, YouTube, that a friend of mine had sent. Now, it was popular with lots of people by that time, but I'm kind of deified with the internet. And a friend of mine had sent me a YouTube video of a guy who had a garage, and he worked on old English sports cars, and he had a MG in there, an MGB he was working on. And I watched that, and I went, holy crap. I said, if I had an MGB, that's where I'd take my car. And I said, wow, I wonder if we could do that with chairs. So Gary had done black and white photography back in the 70s. And he was also kind of a computer geek guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, do you want to film me doing this? He goes, yeah. And I said, well, that could be your pay for making the chair. And so one day he came down and he goes, let's get started. And that's when we got in the truck and we started down the road to the log yard. And of course, the first words in any of the videos said is Gary. He goes, Curtis, where are we going? I said, well, and then I hadn't stopped since, you know, I've been talking all the time. And so we found out people started watching them, and that kind of scared us a little bit. Like, oh my God, people watching these things. And then, people started commenting on it, and we started trying to get a little better. We got a tripod at that time and, you know, wasn't handheld. And then it took us a year to finish that comeback series. And then we just kept going on, and we enjoyed ourselves so much doing it. We laughed, you know, we would laugh and laugh and laugh. And, and maybe it shows in the film that we have a good time, but
yeah, it does.
But we really enjoyed shooting them. And one thing I'd try to throw in about every, I don't know, so many videos, I would always try to get a chuckle out of Gary. I'd try to catch him off guard. And I think it only happened twice. I only got him to chuckle twice. And one of them was, I'm going to show how to sharpen the fro. And I say, okay, now I'm going to show you how to sharpen the fro. And I wait a split second and I go, well, that's it.
Doesn't need to be sharp.
That got a chuckle out of him. And then the other one was, I was shooting, we were putting together the continuous arm, and I was getting glue off the chair with a toothbrush and water. And I was sitting there getting it off. And I said, now, for those of you who don't mind using power tools, you could use an electric toothbrush here. And I don't even stop. I just keep going, just this dry thing. And that got a chuckle out of him. But we had a good time, and I don't know that we'll shoot anymore or not. But I think there might be close to 130 of them.
Yeah.
Up there. Then people started wanting the plans, and I thought, well, shoot, how do I do this? And that led to this nice little supplemental income that I've got, all from just having a good time shooting those videos. So I know that I started out shooting the videos to give the information away. I just didn't feel it was fair, and I still don't think it's fair for people to have to pay $1,600 or $2,000 for a class. Now, I have to have that to teach the class.
Yeah.
But so I feel that I need to do something about that. And that's what those videos are, is to try to rectify that inequity, that the only people that can come take our classes are the people that have a very comfortable income, not the people who might be making chairs for a living in the future.
Right. Right. And that's what's great about those videos is, you buy a set of those plans and, you follow those videos. Yeah, you can build that chair. You lay out every step, and then, I mean, not only do you lay out every step, but you go over it twice, basically, in those videos. And you also, you know, hey, here's a mistake you might make.
Yeah, here's a mistake I just made.
Or here's a mistake I just made, and here's how you fix it, because that's the most important part.
Sometimes Gary will go, okay, Curtis, I'm going to edit out that mistake because you've shown you're human already too many times today. you do what you want. Yeah.
Well, fantastic. And thanks again for all you do.
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices. So I guess I'll start off. So I'm just enjoying the trusty old Guinness. So I don't know.
Trusty old Guinness.
There's not much more you can say, you know. It's
where's your would you stick a butter to go with it?
Oh, come on. Guinness is actually a very light beer.
It really is.
Yes.
I had a college friend who swore he could live for 2 weeks nothing but Guinness and butter.
But anyway, so Sean, what are you drinking?
So I went to the store this evening, and I was happy to find that Bell's Hop Slam had been released. I think the timing was right because it's usually one that goes pretty quick. That's a Bell's. It's a Middle Michigan brewery, and it's their double IPA coming in at 10%. So it's a bit of a punch of a Midwest IPA. But it's very good, and I've been able to have it on a few occasions across a couple of years, and it's very good. Very good.
Excellent. Yeah, and
Mark, Diami, what are you wearing?
Yeah, I went very sessionable tonight.
Oh, sessionable.
Oh, boy.
A Saranac Lil Hazy, which is just an ale. And it's clean and delightful.
Fantastic. Mark,
I have the sister to Lil Hazy, which is Sierra Nevada Hazy Little Thing.
Ah.
That's not bad.
Also, I've had delightful.
That's a good one. So Curtis, do you have anything to recommend?
Well, last night I had a Highland chocolate stout. Which is Highland Brewery in Asheville, North Carolina, which has more breweries per capita than any city in the world, I believe.
It's the cesspool of the South.
Yeah.
It is. To their celebration.
Yeah. And the only thing I've got in my refrigerator right now, my son-in-law brews, and he brewed us some stouts for Christmas. They gave it to us for Christmas. They could be porters. I forgot. He said, keep them on the shelf till January 6th and then stick them in the refrigerator. And that's what I did. And I didn't, I have to look at them again. Anyway, it's either a stout or a porter, but we have a good brewery in our town, a little tiny brewery called Depot Street. And, I'll usually try to, buy my stuff from them and them business, especially now during the COVID epidemic, trying to throw my money their way, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I got to cheat, though, because also, besides the hops, I had another Founders KBS, which is their Kentucky Barrel Stouts. And this one was an espresso stout brewed with some sort of coffee. And it was very good as well. I like to hear from another person that likes stouts, like true stouts. I don't consider Guinness a stout. Guinness is kind of a weird, like, in between.
Okay, I have had a few stouts, but yeah, they're good. Well, like I've said before on the show, I prefer Murphy's over Guinness, but Murphy's is just harder to find. But again, that's they're more similar than different. But so. Yeah,
I know. I get it. Yeah. I that's all in jest. I drink Miller Lite on top of my stouts. It's fine.
Well, I know you do. I know you do.
You make a Miller Lite stout bomb?
No, not really a bomb. No. Yeah. No, just as a chaser, moreover.
There you go. Well, with that, Curtis, where can folks find you if they want to reach out and check out your plans or whatnot?
The website is Curtis Buchanan. chairmaker.com and then Eric's been putting stuff up for me on Instagram. I still don't own a phone, so I can't even go there. It says it up at the top, can't answer any of your questions. I don't have so Eric's been handling that, and that's been fun, you know, those little tiny 1 minute videos that you don't have to put any time in. And
I know they've been great. It's wonderful to see you there. And I never comment on your post because I know you're not going to see it. So, but no, they are absolutely fantastic. And then, of course, you're Curtis Buchanan on YouTube also. So check that out.
Right. Curtis Buchanan. Yeah. I guess in March, I'll have to learn something. Eric's going to go back to Vermont and, I'm going to have to make up my mind if I'm going to keep the Instagram thing going with him gone.
You got to keep it going.
You got to keep it going.
Consistency is the key. Yeah.
Well, that just means you need another apprentice that, you know, Instagram's going to have to be one of their fortes.
Yeah.
I mean, how are you with your hands and how are you with social media? two qualifiers.
So, Mark, where can folks find you?
I am at plate11.com, and on Instagram, I am at Mark Builds It, and I have a short video coming out tomorrow on YouTube, Plate 11 Woodworking.
Oh,
good. And Sean, what about you?
Pretty much anywhere you look, I'm SeanW78. And Sean, just if you're curious, is spelled S-E-A-N. I don't know how to spell that, but that's it. And Diami, how about you, man?
I can be found on Twitter at Diami Plotke.
Oh, not on the only social media that matters?
I'm there too, but
Well,
Kyle?
As you know, you can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that, that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. The best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.